Hello and welcome to this episode of Fitness Unfiltered with my wonderful co-hosts, Dan and Emma. Dan and Emma, how are you?
Great.
I'm amazing.
Excellent. Nobody is fine today. That is good. And a turn up for the books. And we are joined today by an exceptional special guest who actually we've been trying to get on the podcast for years. And when I say trying, I mean like we've had on our list, but not actually asked until quite recently, and now have managed to get her on. And she's called Helen West, and she is part of the Rooted Project, who wrote an awesome book a few years back called Is Butter a Carb, isn't it? It was the question.
Is Butter a Carb, yeah, that's
right. I was going to get your book title wrong, jeez. and we have had lots of conversations behind the scenes about these sorts of topics that we're going to touch on today. I would describe them as the nuanced grey areas of the kind of things that we like to talk about. So we often talk about things like fat loss, we talk about obesity, we talk about the medical side of things, the health side of things, the diet culture side of things. And there's lots of debates to be had when it comes to issues around health at every size, how people frame things like fat loss, how people talk about making health changes and all of that sort of stuff. And we also wanted to touch on, I guess, what we might term the wokeness side of obesity. So talking a little bit about, you know, where terminology comes into play, how important our words are in terms of how we approach this subject, and whether or not perhaps some of those concepts have taken flight in their own way and perhaps gone off in a complete tangent, as we are inclined to do sometimes. So I've touched a bit on who you are, Helen, but like, tell us and our viewers and listeners who you may be.
Okay, I always hate doing intros.
Me too. Because,
yeah, I hate it. But I guess the simplest way to explain who I am is I'm a specialist dietitian. I've work predominantly in eating disorders, currently with teenagers with eating disorders. But I also have kind of dabbled in nutrition science communication with the Rooted Project. And I've done a lot of work about kind of unpicking nutrition messages, of which there's lots of confusing and conflicting information online and things like that. But I guess the conversations we've had have been more because I work from what we would call a weight inclusive approach to health. And I apply that in my eating disorder work as well. So yeah.
And if I may say, like one of the first
is my timing off, by the way? No. All right. Sorry. What is weight inclusive? Like, because I think that would be a good place to start with, like, the definition of what that is.
Yeah. So I think different people would give probably way more eloquent sort of, I guess, definitions than I would. But essentially, the easiest way to think about it is that it's sort of health focused and person focused, not weight focused. So it's, if you think about the difference between a weight centered and a weight inclusive approach to health, weight centered approach is where we put weight at the center of all health conversations as an outcome or something that we look at to measure and define health by. So most medical models are weight centered. We talk about weight as sort of a measure of health in terms of the BMI scale, in terms of weight as categorized by weight, with sort of high weight being categorized as obese, obesity, overweight. A weight inclusive approach is technically more person-centered, so thinking about health more holistically, thinking about what health means to a person, and not centering weight. So you're not necessarily saying that weight is nothing to do with health, like you need to sort of like blacklist it, but you're just not centering it in the conversations about health and thinking about health in a different way.
Because I think from weight inclusivity point of view, it's almost aligns a little bit more with like body neutrality, in that most people by definition think that most sit in either camp of either diet culture or anti-diet, or if you're anti-diet, that automatically means you're body positivity. There's nothing kind of weight inclusive or you know, from a body neutrality point of view. So I think it's interesting for people to understand the bit in the middle, which is often where we get lost, but social media being the beast that it is, we only hear from the pendulum swings either side, which is why it'd be such an interesting discussion today.
Yeah, and I think that there's loads of different terminology. So, for example, I don't use weight neutral approaches because I think, you know, like that doesn't sort of encompass the fact that weight does have an impact on health, but in terms of weight stigma, so, and also access to healthcare and the impact of weight stigma on access to healthcare and health outcomes. So I don't think weight is a neutral thing. You know, people, it does impact the care that people get, and it does, you know, and that kind of thing. So that's why I use weight inclusive rather than the weight neutral. But there's lots of things like anti-diet, you know, that people use different, and people will use those terms in different ways as well. So it can get a bit confusing, a bit muddled.
Yeah, because I think that's kind of what we want to discuss today as well, in terms of terminology used and whether it's, you tend to change it based on the individual, because it is quite inter-individual, isn't it? It's also population dependent, it's context specific. We've had discussions certainly amongst us, because I know like fat, for example, I've been someone that has been called fat in the past. That wouldn't be necessarily something I would refer to anyone else as, but I do know there are people that prefer fat over being called obese, for example. But I don't think I'd refer to an individual obese. But when we do talk about broad scale epidemiological data, for example, we do talk about obesity. So it's, do you feel you have to be really careful with terminology that you use with people, and it does differ and change?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mean, working with people with eating disorders, I'm always have to be really careful about my language, about the meaning of words, you know, like, as a healthcare professional, you're always like, particularly with eating disorders, you're always like an active ingredient in any interaction that you're having. So the way that you phrase something, the things that you say, can sort of interact with that person's kind of thoughts, beliefs and identity. And the, you know, you can even be sort of part of maintaining their disorder if you're not really careful with what you're saying. I do think words are really important. I don't think there is a single answer. And I think that's a lot of the time where we fall down. I think different people experience words in different ways. So of course, like the fat activist community have reclaimed the word fat. They use that in a fat positive sense. They use it as a neutral descriptor in the same way that you'd use thin. But if you use that word out of that context with people that aren't familiar with those politics, that aren't, you know, reclaiming their bodies in that way, it can be a really harmful word that's loaded with a lot of negative connotations and sort of implications about you as a person. You know, fat is often used as an insult and carries quite a loaded word, isn't it? It sort of implies a lot of other things other than a neutral descriptor. But yeah, I think you just have to be really careful with what you're saying and really think about the context in which you're using it. Think about how you're also setting up people's ideas about what you're talking about, which is where I think the public health messages get really, really murky and really, really difficult when we're talking about obesity and obese and populations and things like that, because it does influence, because of people's kind of, people haven't thought very deeply about this stuff often, and because people assume that weight is a choice, that it's a behavior, that it's not a complex outcome, people just assume that people are doing it to themselves or have made a choice to be a certain size or a certain weight, and so it can influence the way that they, for example, in healthcare, deliver care and even access to care and things like that.
And I think like that's certainly one of the things that we really wanted to touch on. And I think part of the reason for this is, like, it's something that I think I've struggled with in the past. And actually, one of our first interactions with regards to this sort of topic, I've known you for a while, but one of our first interactions was, we actually did a podcast about this, and you got in touch with me afterwards, and you gave us a bit of feedback in terms of how we'd approach the subject, you know, from your perspective, which I found really, really valuable. And I think that one of the biggest like things that gives me professional respect for other people is when people can give you feedback constructively on something that you may have done in a way that makes you want to change your behavior and change your mind and actually learn from it, rather than the way that it tends to happen in places like social media, which is just conflict. And I think that you know, when things are approached positively, we can create positive change with people. But when we just butt heads with people for the sake of it, it becomes very difficult. Yeah. And because of that, like, I like to follow lots of different types of accounts on social media. I follow some anti-diet people, I follow some really pro-fat loss people, and I follow some really big, you know, personalities when it comes to stuff like personal responsibility. And I've always had a bit of a complicated relationship with it myself. And I think that part of the reason for that, from my perspective, is that when I was very overweight, and that was basically down to my own actions. It wasn't because of a difficulty with access to food. It wasn't a difficulty with access to education or facilities or anything like that. So it was basically, it was down to personal responsibility. And I think it's very, very easy when one comes from a certain background oneself to assume that everybody else has that background. So, oh, well, if I can do it, everyone else can. Well, yes, that may be true. Everyone else who is in my position can perhaps do it. But I, even when I was going through it, and for quite a long time afterwards, I don't think I truly realized that that wasn't really true. And so I think for people who are in the fitness space, particularly, who have probably, you know, for, I wouldn't say everybody, but maybe, in fact, I'm just making up a statistic, but let's say 80% of people who are personal trainers have always been interested in sport, health and fitness, and that's where they've ended up in that career. It can, I'm sure, be very, very difficult for people to understand these concepts. And so often they end up putting out information that is very much based on personal responsibility. But that information, I think, is perhaps useful to a certain cohort of people, such as my own former self. But how do we sort of figure out this balance between who gets to hear what and who should be hearing this, and actually we should also be being compassionate to people who aren't coming from that background? Like, what do we do when we're working in public health messaging and social media and stuff?
Do you think that, like, there should be more of a distinction between fault and responsibility? Because I actually think responsibility is really empowering. Like, even if you come from a deprived background and maybe your genetics have predisposed you to being overweight, and there are loads of legitimate reasons that you might be heavier, actually still taking ownership of that is, I think, quite an empowering thing. That's not to say it's your fault that you're in that position or that there's any blame or fault involved with it, but actually being like, but I can change this, as opposed to someone saying, not that, I mean, and not that people actually say this, but I think it's often interpreted like this, like, it's your genetics, you can't do anything, it's your background, you can't do anything. And then you are kind of like, you feel like a victim to it, and then you don't change.
It is implied, I think, in a lot of how people approach that. Like, when people are trying to be compassionate, it is almost disempowering, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I do get what you mean. I've thought about this quite a lot, and I think it's really difficult. And working in mental health spaces, I tread this line all the time in different contexts, in terms of like accessing agency, taking responsibility for an ownership for things when there's a lot of other complex things going on that make that really, really difficult. I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think it's about, responsibility is loaded. And I think that if people want to have the time to have the, you know, to focus on their health, and they want to do certain things, and they want some support, or they, because I think it's more about support rather than responsibility. So it's about support and maybe sort of dedication to your own kind of goals and your own health goals and what health means to you. I think that's really different to fault. So I think that's sort of what you're saying, Emma. I think like, it's like, for me, I always think about what, because I have to talk to quite poorly teenagers about this quite a lot. And we sort of unpicking the kind of the things that they believe health is, that they have to do to be healthy, even though that they're quite unwell. I think it's about thinking about, what does health mean to you? What is healthy? Like, what is that? Because that's going to be different from person to person. And how can we support you to get there is very different to take, you know, maybe even take responsibility, or it's your fault. Does that make sense?
I think part of the problem with the whole cancer obesity campaign, that it was very much like, you should know this information and act on it, as opposed to, this is something that, yeah, you're right, like, we should all know, but here's the support to act on it. And I think that was the bit that was missing. There was like, because it is quite scary to be like, obesity is linked to cancer. Then you're like, oh my God, like, if that's me, that's quite a scary thing. And there was no follow-up of, but there is this support that if you wanted some help to do something about that, we can help you do that. And I guess that is the element that's often missing with like public health information.
Whenever we talk about responsibility, I think of the clangor a previous guest dropped, the ability to respond, and why it is so inter-individual, because is it a genuine ability to respond? So if we're talking about people from certain socioeconomic backgrounds, access to open fields to play, access to, you know, certain health foods, whether they're all their surrounding shops around them are fast food, hyper palatable, super calorie dense foods, whether it is on the brink of a recession, people thinking about feeding their families or just putting 10 quid on an electricity meter? Is it a genuine ability to respond? And I think a lot of the problem, in especially with the media and how they present it, is how they frame it. As you talk about personal responsibility, but we talk about it from a weight stigma point of view, where like people are presented as objects of shame. You know, if you look at, you are in a larger body, and you see how they present that in the media, and it's often fear-based. It's, if you don't do something, you're going to end up like this. And we saw it over the pandemic. You are the cause of this. You're putting this strain on the NHS. And it has that paradoxical effect. People retreat, they withdraw, they go back to what they find comfort in. And it's the positive, as you said, support around that. How do you actually give people options rather than trying to shame them into change, which we know just doesn't work?
And I think there's another thing that's a really important piece of the puzzle that's missing, is that when we're talking about weight and we're talking about personal responsibility, the implied message is that if you are a high weight, it's because you don't engage in X, Y, and Z health behaviours. And that's actually, you know, it's if you really think about that, you know, like bodies, body size, body weight, it's not a good proxy for health behaviours. Or you can't tell, you know, if somebody's been to the gym that day, no matter what size their body is, if they've been to the gym or if they've been for a walk or what they've had for their lunch. But the implicit bias with the way that we talk about bodies, the way that we talk about weight, is if somebody's body is this size, they must, one, definitely be unhealthy, and two, must be because they don't engage in healthy lifestyle behaviours. And those two things, and, you know, there's other bits of it as well, but those are the assumptions about people that are made about people because of the size of their bodies, are the things that lead to the problems, the things that lead to the sort of the weight stigma, the way that people are treated within healthcare systems, that kind of thing. And I think that, like, when we think about choice, like, you know, it's true that, you know, like there's big macro things in terms of like the food environment, in terms of like the cost of living crisis and things like that. But there's loads of little stuff as well. Like, you know, like stay at home moms, like childcare is really expensive. You know, people's lives are really, really busy. Like, you know, it's like, where do health behaviors fit into that? And what is actually people's choice and people's access to those things? You know, we live in a country where it's very, very expensive to live, even in two income household families, that most people have to work. And so it's just thinking about, like, for me, like, what is health to that person, and bringing it back to individual, like, but true person-centered care, and not making assumptions about individuals, recognizing that choice, the idea of choice, is not an equal playing field. Like, people don't have access to the same choices and the same options. But yeah, I think the biggest thing is just really, and this is something I have to work on a lot at work, is that the size of your body is not a marker for your health behaviors. It's just not, you know.
I'd be really interested to get your thoughts on, because we spoke about the pendulum swing and how it's potentially gone the other way a bit, especially when we hear about anti-diet activists, for example. And I think, like, that also has the potential to corrode health messaging, in which there are certain aspects. Obviously, you can't assume someone's health status based on just their appearance. But if we are talking about inter-individuality and you're having a discussion with that individual and they're not engaging in health-seeking behaviour, they're a smoker, perhaps their blood glucose levels that indicate they might be on the border of being pre-diabetic, for example, you can make an educated assumption on the health trajectory. That would be fair. But I think there's certain representatives within the anti-diet movement that wouldn't acknowledge that in any shape or form. And especially when some of those may represent a medical board, for example, which, if you're of my parents' generation or my grandparents' generation, you trust what a doctor says implicitly. So when you have doctors that won't acknowledge any potential pros for anyone in particular, any individual on the planet, to potentially intentionally losing weight, I think that can be a bit of an issue as well. And I think I've just put words in your mouth, so I hope I haven't.
I think the problem is always the binary, isn't it? It's like it's taking that stance of, like, don't ever, ever, ever try and do anything that has a focus on aesthetics. Don't ever, ever try and do anything. And I just think, actually, it can be, like, I think the word that you used, Emma, was empowering. So it can be disempowering to people to think, because it, from my experience, even, you know, and I use a lot of intuitive eating principles, I use a lot of non-diet principles in my work, I've also seen harms to those things as well in practice. I think that there is an idea that if it's a non-diet message that you're putting out there, then that is harmless. And I don't actually think that's true. I've seen a lot of people who have difficult relationships with food, for example, trying to navigate that on their own with social media and getting themselves into all kinds of difficulties, not getting the right support, you know. It's definitely a problem when you're making very blanket statements about, and this, it's sort of that they're using the same logics that they're arguing against. So if you're arguing that telling everybody to lose weight is a bad thing, focusing and putting weight in the center of the conversation and making it all about that is a bad thing, but then you're doing the same thing with don't ever try and lose weight, any kind of weight loss is a bad thing, it's the same problem. You're not bringing in any of the nuance of the conversation, the flexibility of thinking, the criticality that really, when you think about fat activists and non-diet messages around BMI, about body weight, it's, you know, I think those messages are important in terms of like disrupting the thinking about BMI, trying to change things in the way that BMI is actually used in a negative way, you know, in health services, in the general sense, like we're engaged in these conversations. When you go, and Mike, you've probably experienced this, but when you go into the depths of the healthcare system, 99% of healthcare professionals have never thought about these things and have never had conversations. But I don't know what you think, Mike. That's my experience in the eating disorder world anyway.
I agree. I think it is the absolutism. And I think that I think generally speaking, if you look at the healthcare profession as a whole, you will be unlikely to find such doctors who are making such sweeping statements in the other direction. You're probably much more likely to find doctors making more inappropriate statements in the direction of weight loss being the be all and end all. I think just from a diet culture perspective and from how we're trained to look at health, and also just from a, like, I suppose, the prejudicial sort of standpoint, there is just a societal prejudice that overweight people are likely to be more unhealthy, right? So I completely agree. It's that, to play devil's advocate on the behalf of those, not necessarily the doctors who you might be thinking of, but people who might be bringing up those sorts of messages, I think that the disruption of the thinking is important because it makes people stop and take note. I think the point is that from my perspective and the way that I feel about it is that it is not doctors' responsibility to be thinking disruptors in terms of activism and stuff like that. It's the doctor's responsibility to be evidence-based, nuanced, and to discuss the overall totality of the evidence, not to be like somebody who is just coming up with clickbaity quotes on Instagram and getting a big following for doing so. And I think that that's where there's a lot of conflict, because actually I think that there has become an emphasis on, I guess, personality and this kind of authority bias over evidence. And you see this happen when such personalities post things on Instagram and just get these barrages of amazing comments about how wonderful they are, with a few people like thrown in for good effect who might be making some reasonable criticisms who just get ignored, and then a load of trolls who make complete sweeping statements in the opposite direction, who almost further the definite certainty of these people that they are doing good, because actually, if you know, if you're not getting hate, then you're not doing good, and you know, screw the haters and all of that kind of stuff. And I think it is a real, you know, a genuine problem. And I think that there are a lot of people in the medical profession and the healthcare profession as a whole who are really committed to trying to find an evidence-based and nuanced approach to this. And I think that it just gets muddied by people on the extremes.
And I think what you're talking about is the thing that I see most often, in particularly as it's become a trend. So, you know, intuitive eating had its moment, like, you know, maybe 3 years ago, and it's carried on. It's a problem with labels, but it's also a problem with people just, like, it's like parroting. So people will see things and they'll pick up a diets don't work, or, you know, like that sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like those kind of like little slogans that would be said in the diet world and non-diet world. And it's then you can, what I feel is I can tell where there's a lack of depth of thought and a lack of depth of understanding. And a lot of the time it's the simple clickbaity messages that are thrown out there without actually recognizing. And that's what I mean about the harms, is that there are also harms in those messages as well. And you don't know how those messages are going to be received. You don't know who's reading those messages and what impact that has on those people. And so I do agree, Mike. I think as a healthcare professional, like although I'm, you know, really embedded in that world in terms of like, you know, I use a lot of that evidence. I use a lot of those conversations in my work. But I don't have a lot of those conversations publicly. In part because I think it's become really tribal, and I think sometimes it can be a really scary world as well. So it's that awful thing that if you say something about weight loss or about weight, or use the wrong word, or you know, that sort of thing, it can become a bit of a pile on, and there's been a lot of fractures in that community. It's like it's, you know, in the ideologies as well of people disagreeing, and then it becomes just a bit of a kind of, I don't know, for want of a better word, shit show. But you know, like people just kind of like disagreeing over like the most minute thing, or like banishing people because they've said something that they disagree with. It doesn't become a culture where, you know, you allow people to be wrong, or you help people through or think things through. Just, I've gone off on a massive tangent now, but you know what I'm saying.
100%. And I also think that one of the problems is that because of the ubiquity of diet culture, this affects all of us, like everyone in this conversation and everyone on a wider scale. So I think what becomes very difficult is that a lot of then healthcare professionals, when talking about these sorts of things on social media, are often not talking about it from a clinical perspective or from a healthcare perspective, but often they're bringing their own personal experiences into it. Just as I did when, you know, when I went through my weight loss process, it was all then me talking about my personal experience, and that translated even to how I was speaking to patients. And like, I feel quite fortunate that I then made some mistakes from that side. And I was really forced to take a long, hard look at the fact about how vulnerable I was to doing that. And that was what probably helped me really pull back on that sort of personal side of things and to become a bit more balanced in my approach. But I think that, you know, you sort of see it in a lot of how people communicate, is they've had either a negative experience with fat loss or a positive experience with fat loss. And it informs how they decide that everyone else should have their own experiences with fat loss as well. And I think that is problematic.
I think one of the problems as well is that you'll have people like yourself, Helen, who will think about how that might affect everyone, like how your messaging will affect everyone, which means that you probably put less out because of that, because you're like, this will help these people, but it might not help these people. So do you know what? I'm just not going to post it because I don't want to cause any harm. And then you have the people that never think about that posting numerous times a day because they don't have to have that cognitive load, and they'll just post it anyway because they're like, do you know what, it'll help someone, and they're maybe not thinking about
yeah,
it might not help, and then they become the louder voice. And I guess that's yeah, part of the problem as well.
Yeah, and I think it is exactly that, and I think it is what Mike was saying about personal experience. And I think when you go into kind of like the non-diet fat, you know, the fat activist world, the kind of the world of eating disorders and all of that stuff, there's a lot of hurt. There's a lot of people who have experienced a lot of harm from the medical system. And I am pro those people sharing their stories. You know, I'm pro them sort of putting those things out there. I think it's really important that we look at the ways that, you know, that particularly weight and BMI limit our ability as clinicians to help people, the ability of people to access services, all those sorts of things. But I think when you've been harmed by a system, when something has been so hurtful to you, then you are going to take that stance of this is terrible, this is really, really bad. And there are people out there doing like really good work, trying to sort of navigate the kind of complexities of this. But usually those people don't sit in kind of one ideology or the other. They don't take the binary stance. They take, you know, the more complicated road.
Yeah, and then I guess that's in a way a problem in itself, because it again might make, because I mean, I work with a lot of people who are trying to lose weight, and a lot of them have been dieting on and off for their whole life, and yeah, so many different messages make it so confusing. So by the time they get to me, they're like, I have no idea whether I've got metabolic damage, whether I need to cut carbs, whether I've wrecked my metabolism, whether actually it's perimenopause, there's nothing I can do about it, and there's so many confusing messages. And then they're like, and I've been listening to this anti-diet person, and they say that diets don't work at all. So then I'm like confused by this, and that doesn't help as well. And then I guess because actually, you know what, fat loss is quite confusing and there is nuance to it, that it can just seem a little bit overwhelming. And I guess actually some of the good messaging potentially is a little bit overwhelming for people, because there are so many factors that can interplay. Yeah, then when you come down to an individual level and what they actually need to do for their next step, that's usually quite simple. Like, that's normally like, can we see if you can be more active during your week? Like, how can we, can you get off the train a bit earlier so that you can walk to work? Like it's like little things.
Yeah.
I can see very much how it can become so overwhelming for the individual who is actually really who we're all trying to help.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it becomes like what you're talking about as well. It becomes about, like, it's not about the what they're doing, it's about the why they're doing it. It's about how they're relating to their body, how they're relating to food, how they're relating to the behavior. And that's when you get into the more person-centered stuff, it actually becomes easier to kind of navigate. It's when we make, you know, big broad statements about anything to do with, you know, weight, fat loss or non-diet or any of these things that it becomes confusing, because people just, there's so many different messages out there that they, like you say, they're just struggling to navigate them all. When actually, when it comes down to it, it's really about what does, how, you know, dieting can be really risky for people. And for some people, it's super, super risky. And they, you know, they'll be dieted on and off for years. They will maybe be binging. You know, there'll be lots of things that it can trigger for people. Anorexia, is, you know, dieting's always present, you know, before anorexia develops. It is a risky behavior in some respects, but it's not really about, some people can engage in that behavior and relate to it fine, not feel restricted, not develop disordered eating. There are those people out there as well. So it's about thinking about the individual.
That's one of the dietitian recently, isn't it?
Yeah.
The for some, no one wants to hear for some. Everyone wants just the answer for everyone.
Yeah, for me, yeah.
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 To interrupt you.
You know, there's a dietitian called Rachel Hobbs. Do you know Rachel Hobbs?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Rachel put out a really lovely Instagram post the other week that I really liked, and she was talking about, I don't know if you saw it, Mike, it was about, is it dedicated or is it disordered? And she was talking about health behaviours and sort of really teasing out that, you know, like, you know, the way that you're relating to something. So, you know, are you enjoying regular workouts and doing these health behaviours? And, you know, can you be flexible with that? And flexibility is always one of the biggest things that people struggle with. So if you've got, it's your birthday, or you're going out for your auntie's tea, can you miss that workout? Can you eat something that isn't sort of what you would normally choose and not feel, experience like extreme guilt and anxiety or any of those other things? But if you're not doing those things, most of the people I work with, I've got the bias because I work, you know, with quite serious and quite extreme eating disorders, that, you know, I see the opposite end of the spectrum of the things that can happen when dieting goes really, really wrong, and also the harms of the messaging about weight and health, and how the way that we frame weight and health is completely kind of integrated. You know, those two things are completely combined, that honestly, like, the teenagers I work with and their families are literally terrified of, you know, being fat, being high weight is literally the worst thing that anybody could happen to anybody. So it's sort of, I think we've been doing this kind of like weight-based public health messaging for a really long time. And the number of people that would now sit in what we would term as sort of a higher weight body, and the number of people that have an eating disorder, has massively increased in both camps. And so I just feel like, you know, really something needs to change, because it's not working.
Yeah,
it's not working. It doesn't help. But yeah,
to your point about that, what Rachel was talking about, I do think we do have that in the fitness industry. Unfortunately, we have this confusing avoidance with enlightenment, and we are, to a certain extent, all enablers to a certain degree, because we applaud that. We applaud the eating out of Tupperware. We applaud the people getting up at 4 a.m. and that's often encouraged. So it's easy to see why people end up very, very confused. And I think when we talk about weight, especially, as objective as we can try to be with people, even with messages around like, you have fat, but you're not fat, I think sometimes when people have had a lifetime where they're so emotionally invested into negative feelings around being called a certain thing, it's really difficult to be objective with them.
Yeah, I think when people's relationships with themselves get entangled with like lifestyle and productivity and you know their sort of sense of self-worth becomes tied up with those things, then things get really messy and really complicated. But I think the implicit messaging in public health messaging, really, just broadly across the board, is that weight is a choice and a behavior, that if you, and you know, if you're not engaging, that if you are a higher weight, then you're obviously not engaging in these health behaviors. That's the assumption that people make. And then people start to believe these things about themselves, because actually within the fitness industry and what people think is normal and healthy, that's also not really what the fitness industry projects out there, is it? You know, like if you think on a broad term, like that, you know, it's like teenagers being like, well, I don't look like this model that has a thigh gap and abs and is, you know, and I don't look like this person. I don't look like, I don't know. It's just the fusing of body size and health. It just gets so complicated, particularly when we're thinking about trying to improve people's health at a public health level. And I think people can feel a lot of shame and like they failed and like they're not, not right as a person because they've not done these things.
Do you know what, something that has been a really interesting process for me to see, and I'm sure that we've all got our opinions on things like calories on menus and stuff like that, but something that's really educated me about is just quite how obesogenic our food environment is. Like, if I consider it's relatively normal for most people to eat out a couple of times a week, if not more, and the addition of calories to menus has been mind-blowing to me in terms of the recognition that meals that I would, you know, as a kind of very seasoned understander of calories and eater of food and, you know, like counter of things, I have been really fascinated to go back to restaurants that I've always been to and always pick meals that I have assumed to be a certain number of calories and realized that I was out by a factor of like double or triple in terms of how many calories I was consuming, and realizing that actually what you say about, you know, you assume that by being overweight, somebody isn't engaging in health behaviors. And I know that perhaps health behaviors isn't going out two or three times a week to eat, but a health behavior might be considered that if you go out for to eat, you might choose a salad or you might choose chicken and vegetables rather than a pie or a burger or something like that. And the realization that when you're doing that in a restaurant, you're still choosing a meal that's perhaps got 2000 calories in one meal, that, you know, you realize how little control you actually have on your consumption. I mean, apart from the fact that if you're a seasoned intuitive eater and you're going by hunger cues and all that kind of stuff, which I would argue that the vast majority of the population are not. I know if I go out for dinner and I order food.
On that point, like if it's highly palatable foods, like are you really going to be full even if you have eaten enough calories? Like I don't think hunger cues and fullness are directly related to calorie intake. And that's like, that's part of the problem, right?
Exactly. I'd be really interested, Helen, to ask your opinion on something, because based on my limited understanding, I think with obviously with everyone, but with intuitive eating especially, because kind of my theory around it is it's been bastardized slightly in that it's often used as a fat loss tool when it's a non-fat loss intervention. Obviously, I think most people have that understanding, but I think sometimes it's promoted by people that may have spent, I don't know, like 7 years meticulously tracking every morsel of food that's entered their mouth, and then they've transitioned to intuitive eating. And I just wonder, when you have that subconscious, almost like computer programming code running in the background, do you ever switch to truly intuitive eating if you have that sort of experience of meticulously tracking every morsel of food that's entered your mouth over a prolonged period?
I think you can, but I think it takes a really, really long time. And I'm saying that as somebody that works with people that are meticulous calorie counters, you know, and trying to, it's usually one of the last things that people with an eating disorder lose, for example. I think you will always have a rough idea of what you're consuming. I think the difference is when you're, if you're transitioning to intuitive eating, then that way of living probably wasn't working to you for you anymore. And I think you might have an awareness, but it's more about the importance that you're placing on that. So it's not about not knowing or not making decisions that are in line with your health needs or, you know, any of those things. I think, you know, intuitive eating is a tool, and it's, you know, it is like, you know, the principles within intuitive eating, you know, it is a book that was written by two dietitians like in the 80s, you know, it's a step program for particular things. So it is used in part with other tools, you know, when we're working on food relationships. It's not a catch-all really. But if you're working on letting go of something like calorie counting, then it is possible to do that, but it's less about stopping counting and more about the importance that you're placing on those numbers. And actually, I think the major difference if you're doing food relationship work is you're relying less on external cues and more on internal cues. So it's about looking more inwards and less outwards. And I think a lot of people that need that work are doing a lot of what we would call shoulding and ignoring cues, which can lead to all sorts of disruptive behaviors and difficult feelings. But for some people, you know, if they've been long-term calorie counters, it doesn't really bother them. They might still do that, but then just not still be able to make a choice in spite of that because they want something. I think it would, you know, if you're choosing, if you're making a decision about what you should eat, you know, the calories on the menu, although, you know, full disclosure, I absolutely despise the calories on the menu, but I see a completely different world to you guys. The calories on the menu might be part of that decision. You know, it might inform part of it. You might be like, oh, there's, you know, there's X number of calories in this meal, but I really want it and I'm going to eat it anyway. You know, or you might be like, there's X number of calories in this meal, I can't have that because it's gone over some arbitrary number and I'm going to choose something else that I don't want. And then I'm still going to feel hungry and I'm going to feel deprived. And that means when I go home, I'm going to eat, you know, six packets of biscuits or something. You know, like, I'm exaggerating, but it's sort of, it's never the what is the problem. It's always the why, and always the way that it's impacting people's relationships with themselves, their behaviors, and things like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
I guess really that's similar to what you were talking about with Rachel Hobbs's post, in that, like, it's often not the behavior itself that's inherently disordered or negative, but it's why you're doing that. Like, some people might go for a run every morning and that might be something that they love doing. And other people might force themselves to go for a run because otherwise they can't have breakfast. And it's like, it's the same behavior on the outside, but it's a completely different feeling around it. It also sounds like somebody needs to rewrite the intuitive eating handbook. If you've got any spare time.
that's never going to be me. What you said there, that is literally the conversation that I have with the young people I work with constantly, is that they'll say, you know, it's, you know, be like, but I want, you know, I need to do X, Y, and Z. And it's never about the what, it's always about the why. It's always about the underlying drive and compulsion and the reason that you're doing that, not the behavior. There's nothing wrong with, for example, running or HIIT workouts or, you know, any particular form of physical activity. There is a problem if you're setting your alarm at 3 o'clock in the morning to do it for secret for 2 hours because you need to do 8 hours of compulsive exercise a day. There's a problem with that, you know. So it's not like, you know, there is a problem with going for a walk if you're going to walk really, really quickly to burn as many calories as you physically can in half an hour. So it's like, it's always the why and never the what, really, with most of these things. And so I always think of it, it's much more useful to think about food relationships to me than actually specific foods being tied to health. But I guess that's my training and that's the way that I work. So
I guess with your work as well, that's on a, you know, we're talking mental disorders from that standpoint as well. And actually, some of the reading I've been doing is, you know, those behaviors obviously manifest for a certain reason. So again, the why. So, you know, binge eating disorder, that served a purpose at some point in someone's life before it's become a compulsive thing. It's probably little to do with the actual food. It's more to do the purpose that it serves. So that view of it in terms of intuitive eating, that's really interesting. So I haven't thought about it from that point of view, in honesty.
Yeah, I mean, binge eating disorder, like one of the 101, you know, like people, it's a relatively, you know, it's about food relationships. It's not about food. It's the same as any other eating disorder. So the function, the binge is a coping strategy for difficult feelings, emotions, whatever it is, it's serving a purpose and a function, exactly. Restriction can drive that. And usually, like most people that have binge eating disorder in those binge cycles, binge restrict cycles, there will be some form of restriction in their lives. Now that restriction might be food, it might be like physically dieting, but it might also be mental restriction. So it might be food rules and things like that as well. So it's those things that when you were talking about clinical eating disorders, it is a different kettle of fish. But things like obviously calories on menus really impact people with eating disorders in a really negative way. So from a personal perspective, I feel like they should have flipped it on its head. Like, you should be able to ask for a menu with calories on if you want it, but the default should be no calories, because it's incredibly difficult for somebody who has anorexia to go into a restaurant and go, can I have a menu with no calories, please? Like, asking for that is like near impossible for those people. Whereas I think if you're a person that is focusing on that for yourself, that is something that you probably would find quite easy to ask for.
I suppose it'd be a bit like,
yeah, there is a distinction.
It's a bit like expecting alcoholics to go into a pub and say, can you only serve me non-alcoholic drinks or something like that. Like, it just is a bit, yeah.
Yeah, it's not, you know, anorexia is not a choice. So it's sort of, you know, it's really difficult for those people. And I've obviously seen quite, and it can, you know, for some people, it, you know, in you know, the interest of being kind of complete, you know, for some people it can be a useful thing as well, you know, knowing how many calories is in something can allow people at certain stages in their recovery to go into a restaurant and have something to eat safe in the knowledge that they're not, you know, eating over and above the amount that is their set minimum for the day and things like that. So there are benefits, you know, it's not all negative, but yeah, for the most part it makes it difficult to help people zoom out and away from numbers and external reliance on external sources rather than themselves to make choices. Yeah, I think that's my major issue with that though, is the sort of, it encourages this idea that we should set arbitrary limits on things, and most people would pick just a number and be like, I can't go over that, without any real thought to anything
else. Do you think, in regards to listening to your own sort of needs and hunger cues, that as kind of Mike was saying, that we live in such an obesogenic environment now, that could be a problem in terms of people becoming like overweight to the extent that they are unhealthy and potentially, like, I guess that's potentially, yeah, I guess that's one of my worries, is that one, I think we're probably genetically predisposed to, when there is food available, eat more than what we need. That's why, and I think that's an important thing to know, because it kind of takes the shame away from overeating, because we're kind of driven to do that, right? Actually, you have to restrain yourself to an extent to not overeat frequently. But now that we have such highly palatable foods, I worry that if, and I know that part of intuitive eating is eating foods that are largely whole foods, or like not labeling foods, but more healthy foods.
Yeah, it would be more healthy, yeah.
Yeah. Or honoring your health, I guess, is one of the list of things. But do you think that, given our food choices now, and I guess given our lifestyle now with how little people move as well, that actually if we are listening to our own hunger cues or our own needs, that we'll end up eating far more energy than we need effectively?
I think potentially for some people. I think the difficulty is that it's like intuitive eating isn't focused on size. It's focused on meeting its adequacy, variety, flexibility. It's about taking care of the self. It's about placing less importance on the size of your body. So potentially, you know, people will eat more than they would technically need, but it's about what that actually means in terms of their health. And so I think the idea that it's a complicated one, because for most people that would undergo like a process where we're working on food relationships and intuitive eating, to get to a point where you can actually really properly listen to your body, you have to kind of take away all of the food rules. So you have to strip everything back. And if you've been someone that's had a lot of restriction, that means you're probably going to eat a lot of foods that previously were off limits for you. But the process is not focused on body size, so it's focused on health. And again, it's like, what does health mean to that person? It's about recognizing that, yeah, that might mean that they don't sit, you know, within a particular range of weight that as defined by the BMI scale, but how does that impact their self-worth? How do they feel within themselves when they're eating in that way? And is that a better way for them to be than sort of in a cycle of restriction? And, you know, are they more health in their biggest sense of the word, you know, like as in mental health, physical health, all of those things. So yes, it is something that might happen in a hyperpalatable environment. It's definitely something that will happen during the process of unpicking food rules. The harms of that, again, it's difficult to say in terms of like it's down to an individual, but I do think that is potentially one of the difficulties about discussing these things as public health messages. Like, and also what I've noticed about intuitive eating is it's just become the new kind of like a bit like you said, Dan, a bit like the new diet, but also like people get so hung up on not doing it properly, you know, like as you know, that I'm not the perfect intuitive eater. For me, like when I work with a lot of people, if they go through that process and they go up, they may become, you know, like back down with their intake a little bit, they kind of get used to things, they probably will get to a point where they can pay a little bit more attention to their diet if they want to, and it's not a problem. But it's the process that's important with intuitive eating and helping people heal those relationships with food, and then they can determine a bit more easily about what they want for themselves and what health means for themselves. So yes, they might end up eating more than they need, but that's not really a problem in the context of they're probably healing other parts of themselves that really are causing a lot of stress and damage, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and then I guess maybe they are in a better place because they have a good relationship with food, that if they did decide to eat a bit less, it wouldn't be so much a restriction as I'm choosing to do this. Yeah. And that's a much better place to whether you want to call it diet or like lose a bit of body fat from. And I think what part of the problem is diet has such negative connotations as well, is of its over restriction for a given period of time. And then you go back to your normal life instead of just like, this is the way that I eat. Like, I mean, that's the definition of diet, is the way of like a way of life, the way that you eat, right? So yeah, I guess that's part of the whole problem around diet culture.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I think to remember as well is a lot of the, you know, that the there's a lot of people that will have engaged in dieting on and off, and it hasn't really impacted them in a hugely negative way. There are lots of people, particularly people who were put on diets when they were children, through, you know, because of, you know, fat phobia, because of our thoughts about body, excuse me, and health, that have experienced loads and loads of harm, and just any sort of restriction could be potentially harmful for them. So for me, it's about just not telling people what they should and shouldn't do with their bodies, like thinking about and just removing that from the conversation, just thinking about food relationships, people's health in a more holistic way, and just not trying to police people's weight, I think is the biggest thing that we can do.
On an individual level, how do you, and I guess this will be the same whether you're underweight or whether you're overweight, but how do you unpick, or whether you're in neither of those categories, but how do you unpick the combination of like weight and health that you were saying like is so closely entangled? Because obviously there's a larger problem here of like public health messaging, but given that, you know, I'm not going to wait for that to change in order to help my clients, like how do we kind of help people do that for themselves instead of waiting for big institutional change?
So I think if you're talking about like making changes to lifestyles, then I would be focusing less on numbers and more on behaviors and health behaviors rather than physical numbers. So I'm thinking about how those things make people feel, you know, like I always talk a lot with people about shoulding, you know, are you shoulding or are you doing something that, you know, that you want to do? Is it part of a longer term goal? I think there's also this idea that you should never be uncomfortable, which I really sits like badly with me. Like, you know, I don't like it, this idea that everyone should always feel comfortable all the time, and that, you know, like sometimes you know that you haven't got a longer term goal, you know, that you're working towards. Like, and I think if it's not harming you, like being a bit uncomfortable is also okay. And that's, you know, it's something that I have to work on with a lot of people, is tolerating uncertainty, tolerating discomfort, flexibility, and all of those things. But I would just tease apart bodies from health behaviors completely.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point about comfort as well, because for a lot of people who have maybe had disordered eating for a long period of time or have dieted for a long period of time, that over restriction is actually really comfortable, and the lack of it isn't comfortable. So it is uncomfortable to kind of let go of that control.
Yeah, absolutely, really, really uncomfortable, you know. That is when you're working, you know, and I'm talking like clinical eating disorders here, but when you're working with people who have anorexia, you know, that is often what you're doing, is they're doing really, really difficult work, sitting with really horrible, uncomfortable feelings, having to tolerate lots and lots of uncertainty. And I think it goes both ways, do you know what I mean? So I think it's like, if we're asking people to be healthier, what we're trying to remove is feelings of shame, is feelings of guilt, is, you know, any kind of like things that are going to negatively impact people's health. But we're not saying that people should never be uncomfortable or have aspirations or goals for themselves. And I think that's really personal. It's about, again, what does health mean to you?
I feel like that is the perfect moment to wrap things up. I was going to start asking some more complicated questions, but I think we'll just get into back and forth debates. I think we've covered pretty much everything that we were planning to cover on the podcast. So are there any final words you want to leave our audience with? I think you've done a pretty good job of summing things up, to be fair.
I hope so. I like I said to you earlier, I've spent a full day at work, so I was hoping that I've not waffled too much and I have actually made some sense. You know, it's like having a bit of an out-of-body experience, so I might sort of, but I'm not sure what's coming out of my mouth, but I hope it makes sense.
Not at all.
It was brilliant, and I think it'll be so useful. A lot of our audience are personal trainers, so I think it'll be really useful for them. I also want to thank you because we give all of our EIQ students some reading to do, and one of them is your book, and it gets incredible feedback. So
thank you.
Yeah,
thanks, that's amazing.
I'm glad we finally got you on.
No, thank you for having me, I really appreciate it. I'm literally at the moment, the big thing that I'm working on is I'm doing a lot of training for healthcare professionals around eating disorders, so that's my big focus. So it'll be healthcare professionals, personal trainers at some point, teachers, that kind of thing. So I'll keep you posted.
That'd be very useful. Maybe we could get you back onto the podcast to maybe actually do an episode about, you know, misunderstandings about eating disorders and, you know, levels of scope of practice and lanes and all of that sort of stuff.
I also think, because I think my big thing is I think the personal trainers have a huge role to play in supporting people that have eating disorders. I think often they're the first point, you know, the real face and first point of contact for a lot of people. But there's also really interesting stuff that I'm getting into at the moment with responsibility and the legal aspect of it, you know, like with people with anorexia and chronic anorexia using gyms and things like that, and the responsibility of gym owners and that kind of thing. So I'm hoping to include some legal bits and pieces as well. So
I mean, that would be so useful for so many personal trainers. I even think, and I didn't want to delve too much because there were so many topics to cover, but especially things around the language that we use, because we never want to cause harm, but I don't know, and obviously this is to an extent individual, but I'm sure there are certain things that maybe would be really unhelpful to say, and because a lot of us don't know exactly what those things might be, then we might be causing more harm. And even just how to go about referral, because you're right, I think I get a lot of people who will disclose to me that they have an eating disorder and I will pass them on, but even just the way to word that, because I think sometimes it sounds like I'm fobbing them off or I don't care, go and speak to someone else. And
and it's just this, I think there's a lot of worry about, I think the thing that I get is that at the moment, because there's been a huge increase in eating disorders, so it's something ridiculous for young people. I think there's been a 300% increase in urgent referrals for EDs. There's a 2-year wait list for a lot of community ED services. You know, we could fill my 16 bed unit about 6 times over just in Sussex. So it's there's a huge wait list, which means that a lot of hospitals and GP surgeries are getting swamped with young people that have EDs. And most of the things that I'm doing in the training is just helping people manage those conversations and knowing what the red flags are. But people can do loads more than they, I think people are frightened of saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing. And I think that, you know, there's actually a lot of really good work that could be done for people, because early intervention is the biggest thing with EDs. By the time they get to me, they're in a really bad state, you know, a really, really bad state. So, I think it's really important that people kind of know how to manage and know that they can do stuff that, you know, to help people. It's really important.
Cool. Well, we'll have to do that follow-up podcast sometime soon then. I will be in touch.
Invite myself back there, won't I?
In the meanwhile, if people sort of want to connect with you, follow you on places and things like that, where can they find you?
I'm mostly active on embodied eating at the moment. So either on my Twitter, which is at Helen Lee West, or on embodied eating is the one that I use. It's newish, but the one that I'll be using the most. I'm going to be doing a bit more stuff with the Rooted Project, because we have hopefully got a project where we'll bring I've got this idea for a book where I need to squish about 4 things together, and a part of it's a butter is butter a carb, and then there's some practical stuff for EDs for parents and stuff. So we will be doing some stuff around that as well. But awesome. I haven't really been, I feel like I went into hiding about 2019 and I haven't really been
Well, didn't you have a baby as well? Like, that was, you know.
And that Rosie had a baby. Rosie had a baby. My little boy's 7. So, yeah, I did have a young baby at the time. But, yeah, he's 7 now.
Was it 2018 or 2019 we actually saw you?
I think it was 2019 when we went to that that carb conference.
Patrons carb conference. Yeah, that wasn't actually the worst thing I did that year. I went and did I did 4 back-to-back workshops over 2 days at the British Dietetic Association's obesity conference on weight inclusive approaches and eating disorders and intuitive eating, and it was probably the most traumatizing experience I've had in a really long time.
Maybe we'll talk about that on the next podcast
Associated therapy on your podcast.
Well, listeners, thank you very much.
I'm glad you're associated with that, the actual talks, and not actually just seeing us.
Oh, yeah.
The most traumatized you've ever been. I thought you said that about seeing us. I was like, we're not that bad, surely. You've come back.
No, this is fine. Yeah. I just hope you guys aren't traumatized from my waffle. But
not at all.
I very much appreciate it. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you so much. And listeners, thanks for listening. Like, rate, download, whatever, all that stuff. And we'll see you next time. Bye.